오빤 강남 스타일.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Just 5 months after Korean rapper Psy's quirky dance video Gangnam Style exploded on YouTube, it hit 1 billion, that's a B, views, the most watched video ever.
And as of May of this year, it doubled that record to 2 billion with a B views. The success of Gangnam Style is just one example of how South Korea has remade itself into a 21st century powerhouse in business, technology, and even the arts.
Is South Korean pop culture conquering the world? With us is Yoonhee Hong. She's a journalist and author of the new book, The Birth of Korean Cool. She grew up in both Chicago and Seoul's Gangnam neighborhood. She joins us now from Washington, D.C. Yoonhee, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, we played Gangnam Style, but that is really the tip of the iceberg. We're just seeing a little bit of this Korean cool here in the United States. How big a force is South Korean popular culture around the globe right now?
Right. Well, actually, it's taken off across the globe far, far more than we are able to see in the U.S., just because the U.S. historically, for obvious reasons, has produced its own entertainment. But, you know, we're seeing things that would have been unimaginable just a few years ago, like households in Iran planning their entire meal time so that they can make sure that they are free to watch their favorite Korean dramas. We have Cuba, with whom South Korea does not even have diplomatic relations, addicted to Korean dramas. And what people don't seem to realize is that a lot of this is backed and paid for and supported by the Korean government. The fad is real, but it got a very helpful early start with public funds.
And I didn't realize this until reading your book. Talk about how the South Korean government, along with the business community, has made it a really overt goal to export South Korean culture.
Yes. Well, basically what happened was after the Asian financial crisis of 1997, South Korea realized that it was overly dependent on its big conglomerates like Samsung and Hyundai. They decided that they had to diversify the nation's revenue in revenue sources. And for some reason, they came up with this crazy idea of becoming the world's largest exporter of pop culture. But it sounds like they actually might have known what they were doing.
So crazy it just might work, it sounds like.
Well, yes. And one of the things that they realized is, okay, well, our language, Korean, is only spoken in one country. We can't just expect people to watch our TV shows and listen to our songs. We're going to have to really make this as plug and play for everyone as possible. So what do I mean by that? I mean, for example, that the Korean government subsidized and continues to subsidize the translation of K-dramas, of Korean dramas, into other languages, so that all the local network has to do is really press play, and they don't really have to do anything. In early stages of this, the Korean government even secured ad time so that the local network would not have to even take the trouble of hitting the pavement to sell ads.
And that's just part of it. Also, there's a big connection between the technology and the culture. You talk about South Korea being very forward-thinking as far as wiring and internet connections around the country.
Well, exactly. In the 90s, again, after the financial crisis, the president at the time, whose name was Kim Dae-jung, decided, well, we have this new technology, the internet, the World Wide Web, and everyone is on a level playing field. We don't have to play catch-up if we decide that we are going to be number one in this area. If we are the number one most wired country in the world, we can actually achieve this, and it's realistic. And that's exactly what they did. They laid down fiber optic cables all over the country, and they currently have close to 100% internet penetration and the fastest broadband in the world.
Now, your story is part of this story. You grew up in both Chicago and, as we mentioned, the Gangnam neighborhood. When you moved to Korea, I think at age 12, did it seem like a cool place? Did it seem like a place ready to start exporting culture to the rest of the world?
No, it was really dreadful and uncharming. It was still very much a developing country. They were about a third of the homes in the country as a whole did not even have indoor plumbing. There were a lot of sort of widespread health problems, And it was, in those days, still very much, it was living up to its ancient nickname, the Hermit Kingdom, which was given to it by ancient explorers, well, not ancient, excuse me, European explorers of the 18th and 19th century. And it was still very much a Hermit Kingdom when I was there.
And a lot of times when governments focus on culture, it seems like it's a means of protecting our culture from the rest of the world. So there's like Canadian content laws and all sorts of French agencies to weed out English loanwords and things like that. How unique do you think this effort is, not to protect South Korean culture, but to export it around the world?
Yeah, I think this is really the first time in the history of the world that any nation has made a collective effort to be the number one pop culture exporter in the world. It's the first non-English-speaking nation to try, and they're going at it sort of with all guns blazing on every front: music, movies, food, video games, which people don't realize are 11 times more profitable than K-pop. If you think K-pop is huge, Korea is actually one of the world's biggest makers of video games. So they're really going on sort of amphibious assault, and no other country has actually done this in such a concentrated period of time.
Right, you think of United States culture being exported around the world, and there was some intent there, but some of it was just because we were a superpower with a powerful economy, not quite that sort of level of intent, of really putting together a plan and sticking with it.
Oh, exactly. I mean, certainly American media companies tried as hard as possible to export. The difference, though, is that historically America has never tried or had to really see what local markets were like or learn about them or adapt to them because America, as you say, were the heroes after World War II. They literally bailed out the free world. They gave $13 billion to Europe for the Marshall Plan. And people would automatically buy American no matter what it was.
The blue jeans just came along with the ride.
Exactly. Blue jeans, Cadillac.
The movies, yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing. Rock Hudson, Doris Day, Annette Funicello. It was just something that everyone aspired to. This is no longer the world that we live in.
And you write about, and you mentioned video games, some very intentional, almost anthropological work where people in South Korea are studying, say, the Japanese language and culture to produce that video game instead of hoping that, you know, as I think you point out, American video game producers do, that people will just latch on and forgive the cultural and language differences.
No, right, exactly. I mean, Korea was very realistic. They knew that they had to sort of meet other people, not just halfway, but sort of all the way. Again, the word plug and play comes to mind, where they just say, okay, let's make the game in Japanese to begin with and make it look, for all intents and purposes, like a Japanese game. You know, it doesn't even have to have an obvious made in Korea mark on it. You know, just let's just do whatever we can to make this marketable to the local culture.
You've seen the Korean educational system as a student, as well as researching your book. How does education fit into this?
Well, education, unlike in the U.S., education is actually being leveraged to bring about this pop culture, this national goal, in the sense that the nation's top minds, of the government official who probably took this really difficult civil service exam thinking that they were going to be put on, you know, policies for saving the forest or something, and they're now straining themselves in the position of being put on the pop culture project, rather. And the reason they're picking the nation's best minds is that they see this very much as a science. It's the way that other countries would do, say, the Manhattan Project in a time of war, except this is something like that happening in a time of peace.
Now, we've mentioned the music some. It's made an impression in the U.S. There are also movie directors. We've had movie remakes of Korean movies, and now Korean movie directors directing original work here in the U.S. But how much does this plan care about the United States as a market? Is it about us or is it about everybody else?
That's an excellent question, because we've actually reached a point in history where it would be nice if America bought things, but you no longer need the U.S. market as a lock in order to achieve dominance in the rest of the world. The rest of the world has a lot of purchasing power, and they are actively looking for alternatives to American goods. And that's true for a number of reasons, one of which is the United States is seen as a bad political actor by much of the world. As a country that invades countries unilaterally, doesn't really care about the UN vote, and kind of forces its allies to enter wars. And they've made a lot of enemies, and I don't think a lot of people realize that this will have effects, and already has effects, on American monopoly on popular culture in the world.
You mentioned that Korean is only spoken for the most part in Korea or by the Korean diaspora, but one word is translating the word Hallyu. President Obama praised the quality of Hallyu. What is it? How does it play into the rise of Korean popular culture?
Well, Hallyu just literally means, if you translate it into English, Korean wave. And I've always said that that term is misleading because a wave is something that's natural, you know, that comes in with the tides, whereas this is a highly orchestrated, carefully planned, I don't like to use the word invasion, but that's basically what it is.
Is this something that other countries might try to clone, to replicate, or is this going to be a uniquely Korean phenomenon?
Well, there are aspects of it that they can replicate, like the 13-year slave contract, by which K-pop artists are recruited at a young age. It's actually similar to the Bolshoi Ballet or Romanian gymnasts. They pick them at a young age, and they train them for years before they're even allowed to perform publicly. I mean, that's something that people have done, and it's very effective. But one thing that makes Korea unique that is not very easily reproducible is that it is the only capitalist liberal democracy in the world that basically runs like a command economy, which is to say that the government and private business cooperate in a way that would be impossible in the United States.
We'll leave it there for now. Uni, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
That was Uni Hong. She's a journalist. Her new book is The Birth of Korean Cool, How One Nation is Conquering the World Through Pop Culture.